Ring. Now on. Okay. It is now Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock, and April, what are we, 22nd now? 22nd. So this morning we're doing the second day on the salicylic acid. Sarah's still waking up. Got to wake up quick. Get that tea, get that coffee going. Yeah, I didn't wake up that long ago either, but I woke up this morning and started drawing. So I got lots of drawings to share with you guys. Unfortunately, I didn't finish all my drawings. So you're going to have to watch me draw a few things, but we'll see how I can do that sketch wise. So what I want to do today is last time, maybe let's just review kind of what we did last time. We talked about doing the overall reaction and the setup that we would have done. And what that setup would have looked like. We would have made our acetylsalicylic acid. And then after making the acetylsalicylic acid, we would have air dried it, put it in a petri dish. We would have weighed the crystals, labeled it, and stored it in the locker. This morning, we'd be getting it out of the locker and then going through and taking a weight on it again, calculating our percent yield, figuring out what our percent yield is out of that chemical reaction. And then doing a couple of tests on it, some characterizations. So today is really about characterizations of the acetylsalicylic acid and how are we going to go through and how are we going to characterize that material. So that's what today's lecture is. So we need to start a new note here. And this is characterization. Of acetylsalicylic acid. And when we say characterization, what most of the time people get caught up in is whether or not the material is pure or not, or how pure the material is. And I think that that's sort of a misnomer of what it is we're trying to do. We're not trying to really assess the purity, although we do want to do that. We do want to figure out how pure the material is. What we really want to do is we want to characterize the material. And so characterization is a process of going through and measuring all of the physical properties of the material to prove that the material is what we say it is. So that means going through and doing the melting point, that's doing some chemical tests on it, that's doing some spectroscopic tests on it. And in our lab, those are just the melting point, the IR, and a couple of chemical tests. In this case, we'll just do one chemical test. But in other labs, or when you make a compound for the first time, a full characterization includes all different sort of spectroscopic tests. So we wouldn't only do IR, we would do NMR, both carbon and proton. We would do mass spec, we would do IR. We would do a whole host of different, and if you can, X-ray crystallography sometimes, depending on what the compound is. But you want to prove that the compound is what you say it is. It's not enough to do a chemical reaction and think that the transformation is going to occur in the way that we say it's going to occur. We want to actually have evidence to show that the product is changed and is different from the starting material and is what we say it is. So purity is a separate issue than that, because a material can still be what we say it is. We can have evidence to show that the material has been transformed and is a new substance. Purity just asks, well, how pure is the sample that we've isolated? And that's a completely different question. And so first, you want to prove that it is what you say it is. Second, you want to show how pure that material is. So those are completely separate issues. And the first importance is characterization. So the characterization for our material is going to look like melting point. So we can discuss melting point first. Then we're going to discuss ferric chloride test. And then we'll discuss how to do the FTIR, because this is a solid sample. And so far we've only discussed doing FTIR on liquid samples. And the preparation between solid samples and liquid samples is entirely different in how we do it. So so we'll go through the FTIR and do that as well. Let's talk about the melting point first when we look at the compound. So melting point, we know how to do those, easy enough. But what I want to think about is the starting material. And when we're talking characterization and transformations, we want to think about how the product is going to change from the starting material. So we have the salicylic acid and we have the acetylsalicylic acid. And without looking up the melting points, we could just ask the question, what do we expect in terms of melting points? So this one being the salicylic acid and the acetyl salicylic acid. So do we expect the melting point to go up or down? Which one of these two products do we expect to have the higher melting point? And that goes into what the material, what the intermolecular attractive forces are within the material. So the IMF forces. And they both appear to have hydrogen bonding in terms of IMFs. And that's true of both of these. But do you have any sense in looking at it of which one might be higher or which one might be lower? Because it's not only the IMF forces that go into it, but this has a higher mass. And so usually as mass goes up, the melting point also goes up. So in terms of melting point is proportional to mass and it goes up with mass. But we also know that melting point is proportional to the IMF forces, and that the stronger the IMF forces, the higher the melting point. So both of these are true. And so it's a good question as to which one of these is going to have the higher melting point and which is the more important factor. In terms of how much mass we've gone up, we've only gone up two carbons, an oxygen, and two hydrogens. So we've gone up C2, H2O is the increase in mass. So what is that? That's 24 plus another 2, that's 26 plus a 16. 26 plus 16 is 36. So an increase of 36 grams per mole is what we've gone up. So any sense in which one of these is going to have the higher melting point? I know I've probably clouded the issue now by throwing all of this data out here. Salicylic acid has a melting point of 158.6. And it's usually a range. So I'm going to do it as a range. I know that Wikipedia is telling us 158, but we're probably somewhere in 157.6 to 158.6 or something like that. 158 to 159, let's just do it that way. Degrees C is what our melting point is. The acetyl salicylic acid comes out at 134 to 135. So it's actually a lower melting point than the starting material. And the reason is that you've lost hydrogen bonding. So the hydrogen bonding tends to be the more important factor. So we've got the hydroxyl group here that that gave us some hydrogen bonding, and we have replaced that with the acete group. And so we've lost some hydrogen bonding to a degree, and that loss in hydrogen bonding results in a lower melting point for the material.
I have a quick question about that.
Go for it.
So the melting points for impure substances was depressed on the melting point lab also. Is that also of hydrogen bonding for all of those?
When the melting point was depressed in some of the other experiments that we did, what we were doing was looking at whether or not we had a pure substance or not. That was in the mixed melting point sort of area. And the idea there was that when we have impurities, this is a great question to tie into to what we're doing, impurities in melting points. So when we have a pure sample, the pure sample has a regular repeating crystal structure. And I think that what we've done before is I've represented that regular repeating pattern sort of in this format, where I can get strong intermolecular attractive forces by things sort of stacking together. And they stack together in a regular repeating crystal structure and have very high intermolecular attractive forces between the material. And then when I look at the impure, impurities that have a different structure, it doesn't have to be all that different, they wind up stacking in here and making a mess out of the crystal structure. And so the crystal structure no longer stacks the way that it's supposed to stack, and it interrupts the intermolecular attractive forces. And so we get some areas where we get stacking. And these areas over here will melt lower because it takes less force to pull the molecules apart because the attractive forces have been disrupted by the impurities. So we can say that we've got each of these impurities that are sticking in here now. And this material over here would melt higher. And so we get a broad range that is overall depressed.
Cool, that makes sense.
Yeah. And this one is high and sharp. So it's not broad, but a sharp melting point. When we go back to the question of our material, if we get a melting point that's 134 to 135, we're looking for that sharp melting point. If we get a pretty broad melting point, then it can imply that our material is impure and that there may be some starting material or other side products that might be in it. So the question is, if we get the right melting point, are we getting the right melting point because we have the right product, or are we getting the right melting point because we have a depressed melting point and some impurities that are depressing the salicylic acid? That's why it takes more than just one sort of test in order to identify and figure out the characterization. We can't rely on any one test. All the tests have to correlate and point to the same thing. So we're going to ask the same question of the ferric chloride test and of the FTIR, and we will look at all of these pieces of data together to see what they point at and what they mean. So another thing that can happen is that if we look at our chemical reaction, one of the things that they mentioned within Pavia is to not overheat the material. And that we were supposed to do this chemical reaction at 50 degrees Celsius. And if you overheated it, if 60, 70, 80, what happens if we overheat this reaction? So the product that we're supposed to get is where one of the hydroxyl groups, the phenol, is the one that reacts to make the acetylsalicylic acid. So this is expected. But if we overheat it, we have the possibility of forming a separate product, not the desired product. And it's where both of the hydroxyl groups interact and form well, one's an anhydride and the other one's an ester. So this is possible with overheating. So what would the melting point be if I overheated it? So we don't know what the melting point on this material is, but we could hazard to guess what the melting point would be. Anybody want to hazard a guess what the melting point would be expected? So what we had for melting points is we had 158. I won't do it as a range now. I'll just write it as 158. This was 135. And then what are we going to expect over here? Would we expect higher, lower, in between? What would we expect for the for this possible product? It doesn't have to be a number. Just give me an up or down.
Maybe higher melting point.
Which would it be?
Higher.
Higher. Why higher, Anne?
Because I think the mass is increasing.
Okay, good point. So if the mass is increasing, then your analysis is correct. let's go back and let's look at what happened over here. So we looked at an increase in mass in this one, and yet the melting point didn't go up, the melting point went down. So the increase in mass was not quite as important as the hydrogen bonding. So the hydrogen bonding was a larger effect. So Anne, you're not wrong. Your analysis based on the property that you were focusing on is correct. But the piece that you're missing is that the intermolecular attractive force, the hydrogen bonding, is a more important factor than the increase in mass. So let's go back and let's review that and look at that piece again. And what you can see is that there's no hydrogen bonding possible. That this one only has dipole-dipole. And that decreases this melting point dramatically. So the melting point then goes down substantially. And that's one of the things that is really important to me. That's one of the things that's really important to me in terms of assessing a student's knowledge that I feel that multiple choice tests are just crappy at. I want to know why a student thinks a certain answer is correct, not just which answer is correct. So anytime that you get a test where you give an answer and then you get a wrong answer and you lose a substantial amount of points, it doesn't tell me where the misconception is. And it doesn't tell me what the student knows and what they're focusing on. Because, and like I said, your answer was absolutely perfect based on the principle that you were focusing on. And so when I grade exams and I do these open-ended exams, that's the kind of feedback that I'm looking for, because I want to give a lot of credit for that, because that's absolutely the right answer for that property. But we need to then focus and look at where the misconception is or where the missing piece of information is that allows you to deduce the right answer. So that's perfect. Thank you, Anne. I appreciate that. And that's why I keep want to encouraging you guys to participate and to answer the questions and give me the opportunity to assess kind of where you're at and to redirect focus to give you more information. Okay, so that was great. And Francisco, more dipole-dipole forces too. Yes, as dipole-dipole forces increase, the melting point would increase, but the loss in hydrogen bonding is substantially higher than the dipole-dipole. And so once you lose the hydrogen bonding capability, you lose a lot of intermolecular attractive force. And so it just doesn't take as much energy to pull it apart. Therefore, your melting point goes down. So that's great. Okay, so anyway, if we get a low melting point, we also want to be sure that we didn't make this other possible product. So if you had a melting point that was really low, that was like around 100 degrees or 90 degrees, then we start to ask the question, well, did you overheat it? Is the possibility that we made this other material? Okay, so that's a little bit about the melting point. Let's take a look at the ferric chloride test and what the ferric chloride test does. So the ferric chloride test, when we look at it, it's FeCl3, and it's an aqueous solution of FeCl3, which is iron 3 chloride. So if you're in the newer nomenclature, iron 3 chloride, ferric is the old nomenclature where the IC is the high charge state ending. So ferrous would be Fe2+. Is the OUS ending, and Fe3+ is the ferric. So ferric chloride is the Fe3+ FeCl3. Iron makes an interesting complex with phenols. So when you take a phenol and you react it with iron, what we get is the Fe3+ reacts with 3 phenols, and the phenols bind to the iron, and they make a complex. And the way that I'll do it, let's do it this way. Let's put the iron after this. The phenols bind to the iron. There are three of these phenols that wind up binding to it. And this is the 3+ cation. And this whole thing is a brick red magenta color. It's very bright. It's very vibrant. And it's immediate. So we're taking this aqueous solution and we're adding in a little bit of solid, which dissolves, and the whole thing becomes aqueous and turns this bright magenta, super distinguishable, very easy to spot. And so if you take salicylic acid, the salicylic acid, having the phenol functional group, reacts with iron in exactly the same way. So if we take three of these and we take the ferric ion, aqueous, we drop in a little bit of solid, we shake it up, we get that immediate color. And that color is coming from this thing binding to the iron and making the complex. And we get the red color. So if we take our salicylic acid, acetylsalicylic acid, and we do the same test, the phenol is missing. The phenol has been reacted and is no longer a phenol, but is now an ester. So here what we've got is the phenol group. But now what we're looking at is an ester. And with the ferric chloride, we should get a colorless reaction. No complexation. Because there's no phenol group. So two outcomes of our test, or we could have a couple of different outcomes of our test and interpretations. So first off, we take our product plus the ferric chloride. And when we do the test, it's a pretty simple colorimetric test. It's just 1 milliliter of ferric chloride. And the ferric chloride, because of the ferrous ion, has a slight yellow tinge to the solution. And so if we see a slight yellow tinge to the solution, then there is no reaction because the ferric chloride itself is slightly yellow. And the amount of material of solid that we're putting into it is the same amount that you would put in a melting point capillary tube. It's just a small unmeasured quantity. And so if it stays yellow, then there is no phenol. If we do the test and we get a small amount of reddish color coming into it, then what we're saying is that the test has shown us, let's see, how do I get a small amount of red? That was a little more than I wanted, but that's what I've got. So this would be positive for some phenol. If we turn it brick red and it just gets really vibrant red, then what we could say is that the majority of our material was probably the phenol itself. So super positive. And this would be mostly phenol. These colorimetric tests, and that's what this is ferric chloride is a colorimetric test. Colorimetric tests are extremely sensitive. Your eye can perceive color from very few molecules in making a complex like this. And so the amount of red that we see really is indicative of how much of that material has been converted or is still remaining as the phenol. And the hard part is that it doesn't really tell us whether or not we made any of our product. All it can tell us is that there's a large amount of phenol or a small amount of phenol or no phenol. And the question is, well, did we still make some of what we wanted to make? And it's a combination between the ferric chloride test, the melting point, and the FTIR that are going to tell us that. So when we look at the colorimetric test, you know, if we had a melting point, let's say that we got up here and our melting point was somewhat lower than 134, 135. Then what we're asking is, well, did we see any evidence in the ferric chloride test of any phenol color? And if we did, so here's sort of some outcomes. Melting point at 135 degrees. Ferric chloride test, clear yellow. Now what we have is we have fairly high confidence that we have the right thing, that we have the acetyl salicylic acid. Because both of these tests are pointing towards the right thing. If we get a melting point that is lower than 135, say we get like 100 and maybe 28 to 134, and it's broad like this, and the ferric chloride test is got some red tinge, then what we're saying here is that this is probably a mixture of starting material plus the material that we're looking for. So this would be the carboxylic acid. There we go. But we could say that because there's only a little bit of red tinge, that we have a small contaminant. And we're going to look for that in the FTIR. So we're going to go to the FTIR and sort of ask what's going on within the FTIR. If we got a melting point that was, let's say, 142 to 154, and the ferric chloride test is bright red. Now what we're looking at is this is also indicating a mixture. But in this case, we would expect that the carboxylic acid, the original salicylic acid, would be major, and that maybe we made a small amount of this material. And you can see how kind of each one of these scenarios, we would say that this is a small contaminant in that case. Each one of these scenarios is telling us about what the product actually looks like and what the characterization is and whether the reaction actually worked or didn't work. And so it's important to correlate all your pieces of data and make sure that all of your pieces of data are telling you the same thing. Is this making sense so far in terms of what we've got going? Everybody's with me? Okay, cool. Go for it.
Why wouldn't the iron bind to any of the other oxygens for the ferric chloride test?
Oh, that's a good question. And I don't exactly know the answer to that, but I do know that it is very specific for phenols. That phenols, that this test, when it binds to where I was doing the binding, how do I describe this? Okay. That's a great question, Colin. And I wasn't prepared to answer that question, and I'm not going to do it justice, but I'm going to give it a shot for a second. So when we perceive color, what we are perceiving in that color is the absence of other colors. Essentially, what we're seeing is the absorption of materials, and we're seeing the reflected light. So when we look at a material and we perceive color, and that material is of a red material, the incident light that is hitting that is of all different wavelengths. And so there are many different wavelengths that are hitting this thing. So we can have blue wavelengths, we can have red wavelengths, we could have green wavelengths. And what's happening is that material is absorbing different colors, and only what we're perceiving is the reflected color. And so what we would see there is that certain wavelengths are being absorbed and not reflected off the material. That's happening because of electronic transitions within the material. So if we look at the material and we look at the highest energy electrons, this is the highest occupied molecular orbital. There would be other occupied molecular orbitals down below that. What we're visually seeing is that light is coming in and promoting an electron to a higher energy state. That electron, as it goes up to an excited state, absorbed energy that was equivalent to the band gap that happened there. So this is the energy of light that winds up being absorbed. That is determined by the splitting of the d orbitals of the metal based on whatever ligands are binding to the metal. So there is a when we look at the iron in its 3+ state, we could do the electron configuration of the iron, and we could look specifically at the d orbitals and where the electrons are within the d orbitals. And then when it binds to the 3R groups in a presumably, and I'm not sure exactly which way, but I think it's going to be a trigonal planar geometry. I don't know that for certain, but I'm guessing that this complex, when it binds, is getting 18 electrons from the lone pairs of the oxygen plus the electrons that it has, which are filling up the d orbitals. And we're getting a certain splitting within the d orbitals, and that splitting is absorbing the blue and green colors, and we are only perceiving the red color that is coming off. Each of the ligands that bind to the iron change that energy band gap, and it is the phenol that changes that energy band gap to make it specific to absorbing in the visible, there we go, the visible spectrum, and that causes it to be the red color. It probably does bind to other oxygens, but when it does bind to the other oxygens, it does not change the band gap to the visible spectrum, and therefore we do not perceive the color. The color would be out of our visible range. That's the best answer I'm going to be able to give you right now without doing more preparation and being able to draw the d orbitals and show you the energy and all of that stuff. But good question.
Thank you. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, no, that's a cool question. And that is an entire topic. You do a little bit of that in Chem 1B, I think, that when you look at crystal field splitting in Chem 1B, you do it more so when you get into advanced inorganic chemistry and a little bit in PChem, in physical chemistry. You'll explore that to a greater degree, and you'll actually look at the X-ray crystal splitting, not X-ray crystal splitting, but the crystal theory splitting, and looking at the d orbitals and how ligands can change those d orbitals and change that energy band gap. So that's a whole area of study, which is pretty cool. Okay, so that's where that color comes from, and that's why the other oxygens don't affect it as much. Okay, the next test that we want to do is we want to look at FTIR. This is a longer discussion because I feel compelled to explain how we do the solid prep, because solids are very different than a liquid. When we did a liquid, what we did is we just put the drop onto the sodium chloride plates, but you cannot put a solid onto sodium chloride plates and pass light through it and get a clean spectrum. what we need to do is we need to make a solution out of the solid. And by solution, what I mean is like a solid solution. We need to make some sort of window material where the solid is dispersed evenly, distributed throughout that, and yet it needs to be an optical window. So doing a solid prep is an interesting sort of thing. So here's how we go about starting that. I'm gonna rely heavily on a bunch of things that I drew this morning. And let's just copy this whole page. That'll be easier. And then we'll throw it over into this note, which means that it's probably not gonna let me put this here because I wanna paste it in. That work? No? Not working. All right, one more time. We can always copy and paste it the old way. That really should work though. And it's not liking that. Okay, I'll do it the old way. Sorry, I never tried that before. I expected that to work. Okay, now we're better. Except I didn't really want to scale that. Just want to make sure that everything's on the screen. Okay. So when we do solid KBR pellets, the idea is that we're going to take our material and we're going to embed our material into a solid matrix, which is also invisible to infrared light. So we're using the IR, the same instrument. We use the exact same instrument, but the preparation of the sample is entirely different. What we tend to use is KBR cuttings, and there's a lot of different materials that we can use. We could use sodium chloride, but potassium bromide has this very interesting property that when you place it under an amount of pressure and you generate some heat, that the powder that you get from the KBR, from the potassium bromide, fuses and makes a nice clear optical pellet. And so potassium bromide is one of the main materials that we use for doing solid KBRs. But what we need to do is we need to take the powdered KBR and add our material into the powdered KBR, grind it all up together, get it evenly distributed, and then we compress it at 10 tons or more and make a solid pellet out of it that then we can pass light through and put into the IR instrument. And that whole process requires some pretty serious effort. So first off, potassium bromide can be bought as a powder. But when it's bought as a powder, it's highly subject to absorbing water. There's lots of surface area in a powder. But in the KBR cuttings, and what they do is, just like we talked about the sodium chloride plates, and we sort of showed what the sodium chloride plates look like, when they make those sodium chloride plates, they cut off excess pieces and little tiny pieces that aren't big enough to make another plate out of, they throw into a jar and they sell it as sodium chloride cuttings. And then people can make powder out of that and do what they want with that. They do the same thing with potassium bromide. So there are large potassium bromide polished plates that you can buy, and then they sell the cuttings from those. The cuttings have less surface area, and they're usually just a couple of centimeters. So in height, these guys are just 2 to 3 centimeters, maybe even less than that. Actually, 2 centimeters is an inch. These are probably closer to 1 centimeter in terms of cubes. And what we also use is a small agate mortar and pestle. And agate is the reason that we use agate rather than some other ceramic mortar and pestle. These are really expensive. They're made out of natural stone. They have a lot of sort of occlusions in them that are kind of cool. They have little areas that are darker and areas that are lighter. So they have some white areas and some dark areas that are in that natural stone material. And they're really pretty and they're really expensive. But agate doesn't have an absorbance in the infrared spectrum in the range in which we're looking. And so if any of the agate material were to flake off and break off into our material that we're grinding up, it doesn't show up in the IR. So that's why we tend to use these agate mortar and pestles. And they're one of the fun parts of actually making KBR pellets is that you get to work with these beautiful little agate mortar and pestles. So we start off, the KBR always comes in these brown jars, and we keep the lid on tight to protect it from water. So we want to make sure that when you're not using the KBR, that after you take out a crystal, that you put the lid back on the KBR immediately. We want to make sure that we keep it dry. So water is the enemy here. And we also don't want to transfer any water to the potassium bromide cuttings so that we handle everything with a pair of tweezers. So we're not just grabbing these with our fingers and moving them around. We're only going in and out of the bottle with a pair of tweezers, and we throw in just one crystal. And then what we do is one crystal is enough to make a whole ton of pellets. Really, only what you need is about a third of a crystal, a third to a half, depending on the size of the crystal. So to break the crystal, what we do is we give it a whack. So we just basically whack it. And it's just a sharp, straight up and down whack. And it breaks the crystal up into fragments. And it still has a nice crystal shape to it. These crystals are still perfectly acceptable to be able to throw back into the jar because you haven't touched them with your fingers. You haven't imparted any water to them. They went into a clean mortar and pestle. So we take the cuttings and we throw the cuttings back into the jar, and we only keep about a third of the crystal. Okay, then what we do is we start a grinding process. And in order to grind up the KBR, it's actually a pretty hard material in terms of a crystal structure. So trying to do a mortar and pestle the way that you would normally do, which is in a circular motion, in a circular grinding motion, doesn't work really well at first. And so the first thing that we do is we do a few more whacks or sharp taps in order to fragment the crystal into little pieces. We do that first, and then second, we grind. So it's these multiple motions of tapping or whacking until we get it into fine enough crystals that we can actually start to grind. And then as we grind that material up, the material goes through a lot of different phases. The material goes through sort of a kosher salt. It then goes into a sort of like table salt, and then a fine crystal. And eventually what winds up happening is we get it down to a fine powder. And the powder that we're looking for is we're looking for something that is like talcum powder. We're looking for something that is so fine in powder that we see no crystal structure to it when we visually look at it. So that's what I'm kind of doing here, is I'm kind of blowing this up and saying, what you want to do is you want to observe your crystals, the powder, as you're grinding. And when you see glinting, sort of as I'm drawing here and I'm drawing these little glints, it's almost like glinting off of snow. The reason that you're seeing glinting is because there are still little crystals that are reflecting the light. And the light that is coming off of those is glinting back off. And you get that sort of starburst pattern that comes off of it. From the glinting from the light. That means that the crystals are too big still, that they're not fine enough to move forward. And so you continue to grind it up until you get no more glinting, until you get just a fine, dull gray powder. That's the goal of what we're looking for. And then from there, we put some sample into it. And the amount of sample that we place into this is just a small amount. What we want is we want 1% by mass. So ideally 1% by mass. It's too hard to measure in terms of the amount of material that we would put in. So again, I use that melting point capillary tube sort of concept, that the amount of material that I'm putting in is sort of one melting point capillary tube worth of sample. That's what's going into this in terms of how much material is actually going in. And then once we put that sample in, we regrind it again. And we grind it all up and we get it evenly distributed. So grind until evenly distributed. Okay, now the sample prep is really done. Now what we do is we take that sample and we put that sample into a dye where we compress it. And a dye is just any sort of mold that you use to make a particular shape. And usually dyes are made out of metal, but they can be made out of other things. This, the dye set that we use is a very heavy metal. Look at this, it did go in a whole bunch of times. What was it doing? All those times I was pasting it in and it was working. Clear page, delete page. Delete page. That sucks. I was trying to do that. Okay. Let's go grab the next piece. So this talks about the dye and how we put this in. Let's see if this is going to work for us this time. Okay, so if I come up here and then I come back down, and there it is, and there's a page in between. So we can delete this page and we're in business. Okay. This is what the dye set looks like. The dye has five different pieces that go to it. So these are heavy metal pieces made out of steel. And there's two parts to the body. So there's a top and a base. That's inside the base, there is a very heavy steel solid piece that is sitting inside the base in here. And so that forms the bottom of the base, is that very heavy steel piece that is inside it. Then we have a hole that goes through the top and it goes all the way through. And we have two anvils. The anvils are stainless steel. And a stainless steel ram. And this is what forms the entirety of the die set. So this is a blown up version of the anvil. The anvil is a stainless steel. It's just a small, small disc. And one side is polished. And the other side is not polished, rough. And it's not real rough, it's just not polished. So one side is polished like a mirror, and the other side is dull and kind of scratched up. So you can very clearly tell the two sides of the disc by flipping them over and looking at them. You want to not try to touch the polished side with your fingers. You don't want to impart any oil to it. And we want to make sure that they're clean. So we clean all these parts with acetone before we even start the process of making the pellet. The differences between the two sides of the anvil is that the mirror polished side goes toward the sample. So we always point the mirror polished side towards the sample, and that's really important. So we'll sort of highlight that this is an important thing that we want to check to make sure that that mirror polished side is always going towards the sample. So the first thing that we do is we assemble the body and we put the top into the base and we push it down and we get a little audible click when it goes in. So it just sits in by friction. And so we assemble the body. And then what we do is we put one of the anvils in, and the anvil goes in polished side up. once the anvil goes in there, there we go, we go over this way. Once the anvil goes in, then we add sample, and the amount of sample that is appropriate is 0.2 grams. And 0.2 grams makes a perfect size pellet. And, I forgot, we always make a blank too. We'll talk about the blank in a minute and how the blank actually works. But we put 0.2 grams of our sample. That goes into the die set. So we weigh that out. There's a balance that is right next to the instrument itself. And when we put that sample in, this is sort of a close-up view of what happens. The powder usually sits all against one wall and kind of like forms a little pile up against the wall. And it's very hard to get it evenly distributed in order to compress it into the pellet that we want to make. And you can shake this thing, you can tap it, you can do all kinds of things. It's very difficult to even out the sample. And so the next thing that we do is we take the RAM and we put the RAM in. And the RAM has two sides to it. So when we look at the RAM has a beveled edge and a flat edge. And the beveled edge always goes up. The flat edge always goes down. And we put the RAM in there and we apply a small amount of pressure and we rotate. The rotation evens out the powder and it makes the powder into a nice flat disc. So we want to make sure that we get a flat disc after rotating it with the RAM when we take the RAM out. So number one, we apply a little bit of pressure. Number two, we rotate it. Number three, we remove the RAM. So the RAM is pulled back out. So we lift it up. And as we remove the RAM, the important part here is that we don't want to disturb the disc. So if you pull the RAM out quickly, this whole disc comes up, drops back down, and the powder gets all scattered around again and is not evenly distributed. That's one of the things that's helpful about this guy over here. So this guy is a vacuum adapter. But what you can do is use that vacuum adapter by taking and just placing your thumb over the vacuum adapter. So what we do is we take and just put your thumb over the top of this and apply a little bit of pressure. And what that does is that vacuum adapter feeds into the chamber over here. And when you cover that, it creates a vacuum such that the anvil will not move. The anvil gets held in place while your thumb is over that adapter. So you can lift out the RAM and the anvil will stay stuck down in the bottom. So you put your thumb over the hole, you slowly remove the RAM, and the anvil and your sample stay held in place. That's the idea behind doing that. This would be so much easier if I had the object and could just show you a video of this, but this is what we've got. Okay, next thing is we take and we put the next anvil in, but this goes polished side down. That's gonna make a sandwich of the material between the two polished sides. So the material is now sitting down in here, right in between the two anvils. And then we add the RAM, and the RAM goes in with the bevel side up. What am I trying to do here? All right, there we go. So it goes in bevel side up. And this is the completed apparatus then, and it's ready to press. The press, I didn't have drawn, so you're gonna have to bear with me while I draw this. The press is a fairly big, beefy monster. It's basically a glorified house jack, and it has inside it, there is a metal plate, which is hooked to the house jack. This sits inside a housing. And out here, we have this whole metal housing that fits on top of this. Ooh, that is just not my best drawing. All right, sorry, I'm starting over one more time. That's better.
It's early.
It's early. I'll get it. Okay. And then down here is the body where the house jack sits inside it. There's a dial that sits here. Come on, there we go. And on this dial, it has tons on RAM. And so we can see how many tons are on the RAM. Over here, there's a slot on the side that has a handle that goes to the house jack. And there is a small dial down here that controls the pressure. And then on top of this, this has a heavy plate and this is a solid piece. And on this solid piece is a threaded piece that comes all the way through. So there's a hole up here where this opens up and this guy is threaded and is a great big threaded bolt. And on the bottom of it has a hardened steel piece. And then on the top of this is a, is a big wheel that serves as a handle that you can rotate so that we can turn this thing and adjust the height of it to whatever we want, basically. And then the rest of this is just a solid housing. So these are solid metal walls that sit inside this whole thing. And this whole piece up here is a solid metal piece. And inside of this is basically a house jack. And what we do is we take the die that we have created and we set it right smack in the center. And we pump this handle up and down with this thing in a locked position. So this is a hydraulic press and this is the hydraulic lock release. And so what we do is we pump on this thing until we achieve 10 tons on the RAM. So this guy will come up and usually it starts down here at zero. And the 10 tons is straight up. And we take it to 10 tons on the RAM and we leave it at 10 tons for about a minute, maybe 2 minutes. The 10 tons, the reason that we do 10 tons is because this is a 10 ton die set. It's rated for 10 tons. Taking it above 10 tons risks breaking the die set. And we don't want to have that happen. The other thing that happens is I keep saying that the beveled side of the RAM needs to go up. The beveled side of the RAM needs to go up because you're putting 10 tons onto this device. And if we were to put the RAM in backwards, let's imagine the RAM going in upside down, and it would be inside the device, and it would apply pressure onto the anvils, and then the sample would be between the anvils. So our sample is sitting in here. And if we put 10 tons onto this, then what happens is the metal starts to fatigue and mushroom. And what will look like, what it'll look like after we put 10 tons on it, is this piece up here starts to look like this. It mushrooms out. Once it mushrooms out, the problem is you cannot then use the RAM to be able to do this step. So this step where we go in and we flatten out, so we're looking to do this here, and we're trying to flatten out the material. You can't, if you can't get the RAM in this orientation, then you can't make the nice flat disk. And so if you put the RAM in the wrong way and the RAM mushrooms out, the tolerances are such that the RAM will never fit back into the chamber. So that means that I have to then take that RAM that has been mushroomed out and I have to file it down, which takes just an exorbitant amount of time, where I use a file and actually go and polish that whole thing back down and get it back down perfectly smooth and get the tolerance just right so it fits right back into the instrument where it's supposed to fit. And if you keep the beveled side up, if the beveled side mushrooms a little bit, it doesn't affect the use of the RAM to be able to go in and to smooth out the powder. So it's really important that we always keep the RAM beveled side up, that is the really critical thing, that bevel is always facing up such that we don't mushroom it out that way. That's why it goes that way. Okay, once that is all done and you take this apparatus apart, and I'm not gonna go into great detail, but we just basically twist it and pull it apart, physically pull it apart, the pellet comes out, and what you get is this really cool pellet that is optically clear if you do it just right. And it's got, whoa, come on, stop that. I just want to move it. It's, it's a really thin pellet. It's just like a millimeter thick. And so we make this very clear small pellet. And inside that pellet is absorbed your material. And so sometimes the pellet can have a little bit of grayness to it in some different areas, but mostly it's pretty clear. And that then sits inside the instrument. We have a holder that has a hole in it. It's just a piece of metal, flat piece of metal. And then it has a little clip that goes over the top. And so the pellet fits here. And that sits on top of it like that. And then there's another little magnetic holder that we put over the top of this. And the magnetic holder has a little window in the magnetic holder such that we can shine light through it. That goes into the IR instrument, and that's what we take the IR of. So it takes a lot longer to be able to go through and do a potassium bromide pellet than it does to do a liquid IR. So the liquid IR, you put a drop on, you sandwich the plates, you lock down the nuts, you put it in the instrument, and then the instrument takes maybe 3-4 minutes to run and work up. When you do a KBR, the sample prep alone can take 10 to 15 minutes when you're first learning how to do it. And then once you learn how to do it, then then it goes a little bit faster. Francisco, why did the shape change from a flat disc to what looks like a thicker pill shaped? It's my drawing capability. I was doing it on edge. It's not a thicker pill shape. It's on edge. So it's a flat disc. It's just on edge.
Okay.
yeah. I wasn't trying to make flat pill shape. I was just trying to show you sort of the thickness that it's really just like a millimeter thick in terms of how thick that pellet is. It's really pretty clear to hold them and to look at them. And we handle them by their edges. We don't handle them, don't grab them on their faces, handle them by their edges. And they're pretty robust. If you drop them on the ground, they will crack and shatter. But moving them around, it's like a salt crystal. The heat and the pressure from the press fuses it into the solid pellet. And the only thing that we have to be careful of is not to make them too concentrated or too dilute. So when you're putting in the sample, and we go back to this step back here, and we put in the sample, and we want ideally this 1% by mass, you have to be careful not to make it too dilute or too concentrated. And that's just practice. It's just experience. There's no way that I can show you. We could measure it, but we'd need an analytical balance to get it just right every single time. And that's too much work and too much expense to put an analytical balance in the instrument room just for that one job. And so instead, what we do is we just eyeball it, and you start to learn that the more pellets you make, you learn how much material to put in. And really what I say is, if you imagine that your material were a bright red color, and so you had a bright red powder, and the KBR is this dull sort of gray, the KBR would be impregnated with this bright red material, and we would want the faintest hint of blush that you could get and still perceive. That would be sort of your 1% by mass that we would be shooting for. Unfortunately, most of the organic materials that we work with are colorless themselves, so you have no idea how much you actually put in, and it just becomes an experience thing. Sarah, is the blank just a KBR pellet with no sample? And the answer is yes, absolutely. The blank is just a KBR pellet with no sample. So, and that was perfect timing, Sarah. Thank you so much for that question, because that allows me to explain why we need to have a blank and what the blank actually does. KBR has a small absorbance in the IR range. And what we want to do is we want to run a blank where it takes the KBR IR, holds it in memory, and then subtracts that from the KBR with our sample in it. And in subtracting that blank, we then get a better spectrum. The blank is made exactly the same with 0.2 grams of KBR without any material in it. And so basically what I do is first person to the instrument. What you do is you grind slightly more than a third of a pellet. Say like half a pellet. The first person is going to make the blank. The blank gets stored in memory, and everybody else after that uses the blank. So you grind up the KBR. Once the KBR is ground up, then we make the blank. Of 0.20 grams. Reserve the material that is ground up. The remaining KBR. And add sample to that to make the sample pellet. So it saves time. So you're not grinding up twice, you're grinding up your KBR, you take 0.2 grams out, you make the blank pellet, you run the blank, then you add sample to the remaining KBR, grind that up again, then make your sample pellet. So only the first person needs to do that. Everybody else to the instrument, the blank gets held in the instrument. And here's why we're weighing it by mass. is we're weighing it by mass because, let's grab this pellet. And let's put it here. As light goes through this pellet, what the light is going to see, that got everything. I need to make that smaller. What the light is going to see as the light goes through the pellet is the thickness of the pellet and how much water is in the pellet. So the IR light that's coming through is passing through the path length. And the path length is proportional to the number of molecules. So ideally what we want is we want the blank and we want our pellet with the sample to have the same path length. So that's the blank. This is our sample. And we want the sample and we want the pellet to have the exact same path length there. And GTH, come on. So that means that it's important that we do 0.20 grams for the blank and 0.20 grams for the pellet itself that has the sample in it. And the main thing that we're blanking out really tends to be water. So water is the problem. Actually, there's two problems. Let's address water and carbon dioxide. Water becomes a problem because when we look at an IR, water shows up in the IR as a hydroxyl. So we get all the rest of this sort of blanks here down around the other area, the fingerprint region. Water can show up like a hydroxyl. And so we want to make sure that the amount of water that the blank is seeing and the amount of water that is in the sample are identical, meaning that the path length is identical. Otherwise, when we run the blank, if the blank is too thick, it will absorb too much water. If the blank is too thin, it won't absorb enough water. And two consequences come out of that. So let's say that the blank is too big, too long a path length. So let's see if I can take these two pictures. Copy these, paste them down here. And let's say that our blank looks more like this. So that the blank is really big. And thin sample. Okay, so what we get is we get a blank spectrum that has a hydroxyl peak in it. There's a fairly big hydroxyl peak and some other little absorbances. So this is the amount of water that is in the blank. And in my sample, the amount of water that is in my sample is only a small amount of water because it's a thinner pellet. Then when I subtract the blank from the sample, the result is I get a spectrum where I get an inverted hydroxyl. So what winds up happening is this goes up, and then I get my carbon hydrogen stretches, and I get my other peaks, and I wind up getting my fingerprint region from my compound, but I get what's called an inverted hydroxyl. And that's because when I subtract the blank, I'm subtracting more water than was actually in the sample. Is that making sense? It's a little bit hard to explain, so I want to make sure that that's sort of making sense, that the thicker pellet of the blank winds up making more water in the blank spectrum, so that when I subtract the blank spectrum from my spectrum, I get an inverted hydroxyl peak. The other problem is, let's say that my sample is thicker than the blank. So now we have the blank, we have the sample, and this time it is the sample which is thicker. And so this time what winds up happening is that there's more water in the sample than there is in the blank. So now I have a blank that has a small hydroxyl peak in it, some other small absorbances, because this is just the blank. And then my sample has a larger amount of water in it. So I have a larger hydroxyl peak, and I'm going to treat it like the blank, so there's not much here. So this is more water, and over here we have less. Then the result is, when I subtract the blank from my sample, I will get a hydroxyl peak, and I will see a hydroxyl, the carbon hydrogen stretches, some other things that might be showing up in my fingerprint region, and this hydroxyl is water, not alcohol from sample, but easily confused with an alcohol because it looks like an alcohol. If you make the blank the same size as the pellet, then the water is subtracted perfectly, and any remaining hydroxyl can then be certain that it actually is an alcohol that is a functional group that is in your molecule. So it's important that you're careful with the blank, and that the blank is exactly the same size as your sample pellet, so that you subtract the right amount of water from the KBR. So there's no confusion of what's happening within the hydroxyl area. So that's the importance there. The other important thing was CO2, and I need to go grab another picture. I want to grab this picture, grinding evenly.
I have a quick question about the blank.
Go for it.
What's the point of the blank?
The blank is that the KBR has some absorbances itself, and those absorbances can obscure or alter the...
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. And so we want to subtract out those absorbances so that we know that the absorbances that we are seeing in the spectrum are truly from our compound and not from the KBR matrix itself. That's the point of the blank.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Okay. CO2. CO2 becomes a problem because of how we grind. When you're working with a small mortar and pestle, and you're trying to see and look at this, and you're trying to observe whether or not you're getting glinting off of the material, it is very common to have your face very close to the mortar and pestle. And as you do that, you exhale CO2. So you're basically blowing CO2 onto the sample as you're exhaling, as you're grinding. The sample absorbs CO2 in a sort of dramatic way. you wouldn't think that a solid like KBR would absorb CO2, and it's amazing how much it really does. And so if you have your face really close to the mortar and pestle and you make the pellet and CO2 gets trapped in the pellet, then CO2 winds up showing up in our spectrum and can be confused with a peak. So the area where we see hydroxyls, if we have like a hydroxyl there, and then we get the carbon-hydrogen stretches, that is not a good spectrum. I'm starting over. Let's just do the carbon-hydrogen stretches. And then there is a peak that looks kind of like this. And then you can get the carbonyl peak around 1700. And then we can go into the fingerprint region. This area here, between 1700 and like around 3000, this is where CO2 shows up. And I need to look up the exact wavelength, but I think the exact wavelength is like around 2400. Just guessing. And that CO2 can be very dramatic if you are exhaling while you're grinding on that material. So number one, we try not to exhale on the material. Try to keep your face back away while grinding. And that's number one. Number two, just watch for CO2 in the spectrum. And you can recognize it. You can recognize it by its shape and by its wavelength, and we learn to ignore it. We learn to just sort of put an arrow to it and say CO2 and move on, because it doesn't hurt the rest of the spectrum. But it's just a recognition thing to know that if you've got your face really close to the mortar and pestle while you're grinding, you can wind up getting a really heavy CO2 spike in there. Also, if somebody makes a blank, and while they're making the blank, they are exhaling heavily into the blank, then you can get an inverted CO2 when somebody else comes along and practices more careful grinding of the CO2, so that a subsequent person can wind up getting an inverted CO2 peak, just in the same way that we can get an inverted water peak. So those are a couple of things that are inherent in the pellet and in working with the sample. So let me grab an IR. Let's see, I did this ahead of time. Let me see if I did it right. Let me grab an IR of salicylic acid. So I want to share this. I'm going to airdrop it. And I'm going to drop it into Notability. And I'm going to add it to this note, import it, and see what we get. Hey, that worked out pretty well. Okay, so here is an IR of, this is the salicylic acid. So the name is up here, salicylic acid. And in mocking up this IR, what we get is this peak here is a non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl. It's the phenol. And yes, I know that the phenol hydrogen bonds, but when you put it into a KBR matrix in a solid KBR and it's not in solution, we don't get hydrogen bonding as much. The area that is here, this is the carboxylic acid. And the area that is here, these are the carbon hydrogen stretches. The peak that is this peak is at, let's see, let me highlight and grab a smaller highlighter. And I'm looking at the peak that is this one. That's 1662. 1662 is my carbonyl. So this is the carbonyl of the carboxylic acid. This is the hydroxyl of the carboxylic acid, and the phenol is there as well. And then we have the fingerprint region. Okay. Any questions sort of on that spectrum? Just making sure that we understand what that spectrum looks like and how that is matching up with the molecule that we're looking at. And we could even change, and I can hit the carbonyl in red. We can hit the OH of the phenol, which is this piece. So we think about that whole thing as really being the phenol, but we're seeing the OH of the phenol, which is showing up in this region here. This spike was that piece. And then the carboxylic acid, which is really this whole piece out here with the hydroxyl group. That's really this whole shaggy beard sort of thing that's showing up in that range. So that's where our molecule is showing up. Let's compare that to the product that we were hoping to make, which is the acetylsalicylic acid. So let me grab that one and share it and airdrop it to my iPad. We'll bring it in, we'll add it into Notability, import it. Okay, so here is the acetylsalicylic acid. So now what we've got is, and they give it a different name. So they're saying O acetoxybenzoic acid, and that's what this really is. This is acetylsalicylic acid. The IUPAC name would be orthoacetoxybenzoic acid. So the O is telling me that this is in the ortho position, and it's telling me about where it is on the ring system. In this structure, let's just redraw this structure down here. In this structure, what we have, and I want to do the same color scheme, so I made red and orange. The red color, the carbonyl, is still here, but I need to make sure I know which one is which. 1693 is the carboxylic acid. So this is the 1693. And that is the 1693 that is here. Then I have a new peak, a new carbonyl. This is at 1754. This is the ester peak. This peak is new and was not here previously. 1754, ester. And also that 1693 moved, it was 1662. So it went from 1662 and it moved to 1693. So the carboxylic acid moved. The other thing that happened is that we lost the hydroxyl group. So there was a hydroxyl group that was here. Actually, it's still a little bit there, but there was a sharp peak that was over here that was the hydroxyl, and the OH is now lost and is no longer there. So we could see that hydroxyl peak where it was for the phenol is no longer in this spectrum. So we lost the phenol when we made the ester. The carboxylic acid portion that we were coloring here is still here. So that's the carboxylic acid and the CH stretch. is there. And there may be some changes in the fingerprint region too, but we don't get into those as much. We could overlap the two. But those are the main changes. The main changes are the loss of the phenol, the shifting of the carboxylic acid carbonyl, and the new 1754 ester that tells us that we've actually got the product that we expected to get. Okay, so that's what we would expect to see in the FTIR. And what we would want to do is in the formal report, and we'll talk about this more next week on Monday when we start going over formal reports, is we would want to make arguments that coordinate all three of these types of characterizations, the melting point, the FTIR, and the ferric chloride test, to either back up each other and say, yes, this is what we say it is, and or to talk about the fact that there may be some impurities in it, and we can see those impurities either within the FTIR, within the ferric chloride, within the melting point, or the transformation didn't go as expected, and we have mostly starting material, in which case we didn't get what we wanted. And each one of those needs to be addressed separately in their own paragraphs within the discussion section, but then also addressing each other and backing up each other for the same conclusion, whatever that conclusion may be of your paper. Let's see, what else do we need to do there? Something else that I was thinking about, and now it's gone off the tip of my tongue. I think that's about it. I think that's all that I really want to hit for today. And let's open it up for questions. I know you guys have been sort of asking questions as we go along, but let's open it up for questions now and see what you guys think, where we're at. Is there anything that came up while we were going through the IR?
I have an IR question.
Okay, Colin.
I guess maybe this was for an earlier lab, but why does the hydroxyl group have such a broad and shaggy signature if it's just like one bond?
The carboxylic acid and the phenol both have different shapes that are relative to the type of hydrogen bonding that they experience. So when we look at a hydroxyl group, the hydroxyl group experiences many different bond lengths due to the hydrogen bonding that is occurring within the solution. And I can get many different lengths both here and here relative to its position in the crystal, essentially. And so what winds up happening is I get individual wavelengths that are all blending in together that are making this broad spectrum. Wavelengths that are due to hydrogen bonding, bonds that are long and bonds that are short. And they all add together in sort of this seamless bonding that gives me then this smooth curve. In the carboxylic acid, I wind up getting something that is more shaggy because the carboxylic acid tends to dimerize. And in dimerizing, in hydrogen bonding in a more unique way where two molecules come together, I have less bond lengths than I do in a network or matrix of an alcohol. And so this forms a dimer, this forms a matrix. And because of that, there are more set vibrational frequencies that do not round out as much. And there's just fewer.
That's very cool.
And so it winds up being shaggy in that nature. That's sort of the origin of where that comes from.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Well, this is the analysis that we would wind up doing. We'd wind up going through and doing the melting point, doing the ferric chloride test, doing the KBR, and everybody's sample is unique. And everybody has different issues. And oh, I know the other point that I wanted to make, which is when writing up the formal report and talking about all these things, you want to link them to what you saw during the reaction. So you also want to link them to what was the temperature of your reaction? How long did you let it react? Did you do everything the way you were supposed to? Did you let water sit in it too long before you filtered it? Did you over rinse it? Did you do everything right and everything just came out awesome? All of these things are linking back to your physical observations of doing the chemical reaction itself, so that any mistakes that were made are being picked up both from observation and coordinated to what happened in the product. That's the level of detail that I'm looking for from you guys, are making those connections of, do I know what I did right and what I did wrong? And can I justify that by my characterization and my IR and my melting point and my ferric chloride test? And are they all aligning such that I'm learning the lessons? So I'm not grading it essentially so much based on how well you did the synthesis and did you get a super high percent yield and was the characterization dead on what it was supposed to be so that you had a really clean product. That'd be great if that happened. But what I'm looking for is, did you learn the lessons so that when you did make mistakes, can you tell me about them? Can you justify them such that you can say, this is why my product looks the way it did, and I can track it back to where that mistake happened within the reaction, and I know now not to make that mistake again. That's the kind of level of detail that I'm looking for, is I'm looking for you guys to learn from the mistakes and to not repeat them as we go forward in other synthesis and other reactions. That's the kind of thing that I'm looking for. And so that's what I'm looking for in the write-up. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay. Let's call it a day from there. Let's take a break. We'll come back at 11:10. We'll pick it up for lecture. Lecture today is going to be fun because we get to do SN2 reactions and talk about some of our first chemical reactions and mechanisms and all of that stuff. And so we've got a good lecture, I think, today. And this worked out pretty well this morning for the workup for the acetylsalicylic acid lab. So thank you, guys. And I'll stay on the line if you have any sort of questions. And if not, I'll see you at 11:10. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
Hey, you're welcome, Colin. Thanks for the questions.
I had a question, Jason.
Yeah.
So it's not related to this lab. It's actually about chirality.
Okay.
I don't know if you went over this, but so you said that chiral molecules, they rotate plane polarized light.
Yes.
Why is it, do achiral molecules do that as well?
No.
And why not?
When we look at a chiral molecule, we use tetrahedral to explain most of the time. Let's say this is A, B, C, and D. And let's draw its mirror image. So we've got, that is not its mirror image. D is going to go there, C is going to come out here, and B is going to go back. Okay, so this is chiral. And let's also fit in here something that's achiral. So let's do B and B and D. There's no C. And we'll do its mirror image such that D is here, B and A. Okay. And I think that what I want to do is I think I actually want to rotate this molecule in a slightly different way. I want to make this bond go back and this bond come forward and that bond be straight, because it'll help my image. So that guy goes back, That guy comes forward. And this B goes straight. Okay. So what winds up happening here is that light is circularly polarized. Light propagates clockwise and counterclockwise simultaneously, such that as light is traveling as a magnetic vector and an electronic vector, and the magnetic vector and the electronic vector are orthogonal to each other, and as they propagate, one goes to a maximum and the other goes to a maximum, and then they both come to a minimum. And as light propagates, it has a circular polarization to it, such that we can think of the light as traveling both clockwise and counterclockwise, and they meet up at a particular point, and that point we call the vector of the light, essentially, or the polarization. So as light propagates clockwise and counterclockwise around a chiral molecule, it sees a different optical density. So one optical density might be slowing down the light, and the other optical density, not necessarily slowing it down, but allowing it to travel faster. So that what winds up happening is where the original orientation of the light was a straight up and down vector, and we could say that this was 0 degrees, because one side goes fast and the other side goes slow, they meet up at a different angle, which is now off from the original 0 degrees. So if this was 0 degrees, now they're meeting up over here at some alpha. And when light comes around the enantiomer, it hits the fast side and the slow side, and I get minus alpha. So there's my minus alpha. When I look at the molecule that is achiral, light that is traveling around one side of the molecule and traveling around the other side of the molecule are equal, because it sees B on both sides, essentially, such that there's no difference from the left side of the molecule to the right side of the molecule. And I know the argument that says, okay, well, the molecules are rotating and they are on all different orientations within the sample. And that is true. But what winds up happening is that at the speed with which light is traveling, there are molecules which are oriented such that their optical densities are different on the right and on the left. And those optical densities do make a difference in some of the light that is traveling through. And the longer the path length, the more the light that is affected and the bigger the rotation that is observed. But for an achiral molecule, no matter the orientation of the achiral molecule, the light sees the same thing around the left and around the right sides, and there is no difference, and there is no rotation of the plane polarized light. So achiral molecules, by their very nature of being symmetrical, do not rotate plane polarized light, whereas it's the optical densities differences of chiral molecules that does rotate plane polarized light.
Wouldn't the alpha and the negative alpha cancel each other out?
They would. So when you have a chiral molecule that is a racemic mixture, there is no rotation of light in a racemic mixture.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's exactly right. If the mixture is racemic and you have equal amounts of both enantiomers, then they do cancel each other out and you get zero rotation. So that's why we say that a racemic mixture is non-optically active. It doesn't mean that there aren't chiral molecules in it. It just means that the plus rotation and the minus rotation have canceled each other out and there is no observed rotation. So that's correct.
And so could you explain again the achiral molecule? Why? Because it looks like it should come faster on one of the sides because one has D.
One does have D, but if we take D and we sort of orient D backwards, so let's put D backwards and then let's do it in sort of a Newman projection. Mm-hmm. And then if I do it in a Newman projection, I get B on both sides and A.
Oh, okay.
And now you can see the equivalence of what happens there. But if I do that with the chiral one and I put D in the back saying D is the lowest priority, then I've got A, I've got B, and I've got C. And you can clearly see the differences in the molecules and the different optical densities that can happen.
I see. Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, helps a lot. Thank cool. you.
Yeah, you're welcome. That is one thing, Francisco, that is generally not dealt with in terms of explaining chirality, that the physical manifestation of why it rotates plain polar S light is very rarely sort of discussed. And it's much more of in the nature of physics than it is in of chemistry of why that actually happens. And that's the best explanation that I've seen for why it happens is the circularly polarized nature of light and how it interacts with the different optical densities.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, good question. All right, you guys good to call it? We'll take a break. We'll come back in 20 minutes at 11:10 and we'll pick up in lecture.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Dina. All right, I'll see you guys at 11:10.